This is part three of the recording of Maine Wind Power Forum in Rockport, Maine, May 20th, 2010. This 50-minute section includes a discussion by Des Fitzgerald of the Camden Plan for Ragged Mountain, as well as a lengthy question and answer period where Mr. Fitzgerald, Dr. Dagger, Mr. Podolsky, and Ms. Pudi are questioned.
Energy Committee and what we've been doing. This committee started in 2008, and among its four charters, one of them was to work with the town staff and other town committees on the exploration of alternative energy resources, including but not limited to the continuation of the exploration and development of wind energy at Ragged Mountain. So we took that seriously, and in fact in 2006, other folks in town began to look at Ragged Mountain, ended up putting a Met Tower up there at no cost to the town, thanks to the University of Massachusetts. And it turns out that we measured wind from July of 2008 to, I think it was October of 2009, and it looks like we have extraordinary wind speeds up there. It feels to our committee that we owe it to the town of Camden and perhaps other towns to begin to explore the possibilities of wind on Ragged Mountain. Nobody in our committee is committed to anything. We are certainly only in an exploration mode at this point. Not long ago, we hired the Island Institute. George Baker and Suzanne and her group spent a little bit of money through the town select board to have George's group look at what kind of a structure could bring wind energy to this community and other communities. This was after listening to two or three developers that came in and talked to our committee and discussed the possibilities of what it would look like on top of Ragged Mountain for them to come in, capitalize the project, and then sell the power. And basically, Camden and possibly the other towns would be left with a lease payment. That didn't feel right to us. It felt like for us to look at the possibility of Ragged Mountain being a development site, an iconic site like that that many of us know and love, we as a community are going to have to understand and feel the electrons coming from that development. We're going to need to be a part of it in every way, shape, and form. And so the message to George Baker and his group was, can you deliver a system, a structure to us that allows that to happen, allows the communities to buy into a project like this? And is there a structure out there that's both legal and economic, and we can make that happen? Our committee meets the first Monday of every month. We meet at 5:30. It's been public meetings from the start. It continues to be a public meeting. On June the 15th, George Baker's group will present to the town select board. If you have an interest in Ragged Mountain and what could happen there, please come. This is all very preliminary. All we know is that we think we may have a structure that the town or towns could look at and entertain to see if there's a next step. Quite honestly, the Camden Energy Committee would love to make the next step not be them, but have the town, if it has the will, or towns, plural, if they have the will, to take this project to the next step, which is going to require some money and some organizational skills, and we're going to see what happens. So that's kind of where we are. We're right at the cusp of hearing for the first time what that structure might look like. Got a couple of review meetings with Suzanne and her group, so we have a sense of where we're headed, and the town will hear it for the first time on the 15th. So join us if you will.
And we've heard Habib many times mention about how you've been working on wind turbines and submersibles.
Well, if you have 3 minutes, and I don't know how we're doing on time, but there's a thumb drive there on my computer. If you can, Habib, can I use your computer?
Sure.
We'll take a thumb drive. There's a video on there.
Does your video
open
a Mac?
This is
never mind.
That's me.
So if we can get this thing to run, it's the video, yeah?
Yeah.
This is a little look into the future of what offshore wind might look like. A little more detail on what Habib was talking about. This is our technology, which is a semi-submersible platform. As Habib said, the three design basically accepted platform designs that are out there right now all have their genetics in the offshore oil platform world. Ours does as well. Ours, the tension leg platform, and the spar that Habib was showing us. Can you go Apple F, Habib, please? The music is horrible. I can't hear it anymore. So I'm just going to. So you saw the spar buoy being commissioned. This is a platform that gets commissioned quayside. It's deballasted quayside. The mast can be stepped quayside. The nacelle mounted and the turbine blades as well. And then what you have is a semi-submersible platform that can be towed, reballasted, and towed offshore. So if you ever want to replace the turbine, you can demoor it and tow it back ashore again. Totally flexible. We're going to go out. Just happens to look a little bit like the Camden Hills in the distance as we swing around. But this is what an operating wind farm would look like with our platform. The platform arrives. The moorings are already set in place. These columns are about 135 feet high. They sit about 75, 80 feet underwater. You see it being ballasted now. Watch the water as it's moving. So the reason for this ballast system is really to keep a trim on this platform. You've also got the tipping of the blades in coordination with this ballast system. So as the wind begins to move, you can see the water, tons of water, moving from one column to the other to compensate for that wind position. This is a very large piece of construction, 4,500 tons, plus or minus. You have big baffle feet at the bottom. These are heave plates, essentially, that give far more stability, and you have mooring lines. We'll go underwater. You can see the mooring lines, and you can see the power line. They're those big heave plates at the bottom. Each heave plate angle is 45 feet. Here's your power line now going to the rest of the farm off of this one turbine. Power lines can either be buried or they can be on top of the surface of the ocean. You're picking up the other grids along that line. You're picking up the last column coming in. Now you have four lines going to a conditioning platform, moored the same way, similar construction as to the wind platforms. There's the conditioning platform. That basically gets the electrons ready to be shipped ashore, and that's essentially the system in and of itself. We envision a farm of anywhere between 200 to 500 megawatts. Our turbine platform is essentially agnostic to any platform or any turbine design. You can pick anything from a 2 to a 10 megawatt turbine. As Habib alluded to, they're probably going to be 20 megawatt turbines in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add to this design, if you remember the Cape Wind project, you know, they want to drive these 13 foot diameter piles into the seabed. Think about the environmental impact of driving these piles into the seabed versus just throwing something out there and dropping anchor. So 30 years from now, you can just bring it back to shore. So the environmental impact is so much less with floating wind turbines than with fixed-base turbines. So besides the fact that you don't see them, and the wind's better to start with out there. So that's why we're going in that direction.
Okay. We went to the question and answer period. I realize, sorry that our 15-minute sessions took a little bit longer than 15 minutes, but... but again, like I said, we have a key to the house, so it's up to you.
See, it was so much fun. It felt just like 15 minutes.
Yeah, well, you got a couple of that. Stevie, we'll take as long as you want to answer the questions, and feel free to go ahead. First one.
Yeah, Fred Kulon. You mentioned the conditioning platforms in the video, which are collecting the electrons from the various windmills on the farm. Could you speak conceptually about the number of cables that would be required to transport that amount of energy to land, and what type of hard infrastructure would be required?
Europe's been at this for a long time. In order for us to be cost effective, 20 to 50 miles offshore, you can't build a 25 megawatt farm, which is too small. To scale, you need to be in the 500 to 1,000 megawatt range, to make it all work. Now, the neat thing is, about 1,000 megawatts of cable, is only 6 inch diameter if you use HVDC, high voltage direct current cables. But when you about 30 to 40 miles offshore and about 500 to 1,000 megawatts, you can use these high voltage direct current cables. Okay. 6 inch diameter is all what you need, one cable. Of course, everything collects into one cable and comes back to shore in that cable. If you're closer than that, if you know what they're doing in Massachusetts, for example, Cape Wind, they're about 6 miles from shore. So if you're 6 miles from shore, you go to AC. AC is a lot cheaper for that short distance. Now, the HVDC also, they have a lot less loss in the current, so they're a lot more efficient. So when you're transmitting over 30 miles or 40 miles, the loss is minimal for HVDC. But you can't afford HVDC until you get to about that 30, 40-mile distance. And you've got to have a big farm. Now, how much of the cost of the farm would that be, that single, that cabling coming back to shore? It depends on how big the farm is and how far it is from shore. But roughly, the goal is about 10 to 20% of the cost of the capex of the project. So,
and one transmission corridor on land tie-in, how does that work?
Yeah, where you tie in on land, of course, depends on the infrastructure you have on land. But one of the first projects might be here to tie in at the old location of the, of course, the nuclear power plant facility, where there's a lot of, we have about 700 megawatt cable transmission line available today to us.
Yeah,
it was gas. Yeah, it was gas. So this could be one possibility. But there'd be others, other possibilities as well. And now the other interesting thing is one of the companies in Maine, Shinbro, has built these cables already. If you go on the web, you go to a project called Neptune, type Neptune, and the Neptune project is about a 60-mile long undersea cable that Pete Vigue built here in the northeast off New Jersey. And that cable is about a 0.7, I believe, megawatt, 6-inch diameter. And that cable sits on his desk, so you can go see it on the desk if you want. Okay, it's about this big. Okay. And then what you want to do is you want to bury that cable, though, under the seabed about 6 feet, typically. And there's equipment to do that if you have right soil conditions. Just blow the, you form a trench, if you wish, and you bury it as you go. Or you can actually burn it so you don't drag it with an anchor and cut it up. So, but one cable is all you need.
I have two questions. One is related to the last question. Instead of building a cable from the wind farms, what about the concept of converting the electricity to hydrogen, yep, ammonia, and yep, transporting it in?
Yeah, actually, this is certainly something we should be looking at seriously.
That's why.
Michael, good ideas. I think we should look at all of these ideas. One of the ideas that we've been looking at, and again, the Ocean Energy Institute is looking at it more than we are, is converting that electricity to ammonia, if we can, and then transporting the ammonia by tankers back to shore and then or pipeline or whatever you want to do. So if you have an ammonia facility offshore, you can pipe the ammonia in or bring the ammonia in by tanker. These are things people have looked at. Hydrogen storage is another option other than that as well. And if you create ammonia, you create also desalinated water, which solves another major problem that we have globally, which is the availability of fresh water. So yes, all of those options should be on the table and should be studied carefully.
Thank you. My other question is, what about the vertical access, axis, wind turbines? Yes. Does that solve any of the problems we have otherwise?
Excellent question. The question, as you know, these turbines that we're talking about are 300 feet up in the air. You're talking about 200 to 300 tons, 300 feet up in the air. How many of you build a boat and put the weight up top? So that's basically what we've got. So it doesn't make sense to do it that way, so you have to balance it at the bottom off. If you use a vertical axis turbine, you can have the guts of it down near the water, close to the water, and thereby get that center of gravity down. It is feasible. To do that, we're looking at that. There's some companies who develop projects like that. A vertical axis turbine essentially turns vertically, right? Instead of turning, so it has a vertical turbine, and it turns vertically. And then essentially the generator is near the base, so you don't have to have a generator way up there and the guts of it way up there. The issue with vertical axis turbines, and they've been tried in California in the late 70s and early 80s, actually the first vertical axis wind farm was built in California. And that farm is operated for about 15 years, but a lot of problems with fatigue. Those blades actually have fatigued and fallen apart fairly quickly. They're not as efficient as horizontal axis turbines. You lose about 10 to 20% efficiency if you go to vertical axis versus horizontal axis. However, in offshore, you may be able to pay and live with that loss in efficiency if you can get that center of gravity down and have more stable platforms, reduce the cost of platform. Good ideas, and we'll look at those.
This is to Habib and Dez. First, Habib, you were talking about nameplate power. So 5 gigawatts of wind doesn't give you 5 gigawatts of electricity.
That's correct.
At most, you get maybe half of that.
That's correct. About 40% of that to 45%.
Right. The factors of 2 in there.
Yep.
And the other thing is that if the high wind spar is one of the deployments of choice, that draws 100 meters. Is that?
Yeah.
But wind float is like 25 meters.
That's right.
So the big trick with the high wind is when do you flip it vertical?
Exactly.
And to drag that out horizontally, you need 300 feet of water.
That's correct.
So isn't that the big trick between
these
two technologies?
You put your finger right on it. Every one of these designs has pros and cons.
Right.
Okay. And what we're doing here is digging very deep with a lot of engineers and scientists and experts in this field to look at the pros and cons of every one of these in the main environment. Okay. The high wind design is simple. It's the big floating tube with a keel at the bottom. So that's the beauty of it. Okay. It's very simple. However, it draws 300 feet worth of water. So what you want to do is try to figure out how to get it out there. One way to get it out there, and people are looking at that right now, is you can still assemble the whole thing at an angle in the facility. So I put it on a ship that takes it at an angle way out there, flip it up with the ship, and then let it go. So there's ways around those issues. The wind float, of course, doesn't have that problem. So you can build the wind float in BAP Ironworks with high dock and flood it and throw it out there. So you don't have a problem with the draft on that. The advantage, though, that's the advantage of the wind float. The disadvantage of the wind float is you're in the wave environment. So a lot of it is subjected to waves in the wave environment, whereas with the spar, the tube design, there's less area that's subjected to waves. And so it moves less under the wave environment. So every one of those has pros and cons. And the jury's still out in terms of knowing what makes sense. It may be that at the end of the day, more than one solution makes sense. And we'll find that out.
Excellent question. Excellent observation, however.
Yeah, was that answered?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. So just following up on what you're talking about, so how would, because it costs a lot of money to test these technology, but you're trying to find the one that is the most efficient in your main environment, how is it going to proceed between wind float and this other design? How are you going to really, really test and see this?
Tough question. To answer your question, we have a 200-page proposal that we sent to the Department of Energy, how we're going to do it. We'd like to do it on the cheap, to the extent that we can. So we have a three-phase approach. First of all, we're doing a lot of modeling work, design work using numerical models and numerical tools to see what works better than the others. So that's the other phase is we're doing what we call scale models, and these have been used in the industry in building offshore orbits for the last 30 or 40 years. What you do is you build a smaller unit, and you put it in a wave wind tank facility. These orbits that are built out there by the oil industry, they typically start with a small model where they put in a wave wind tank and test it out, see how it works after you've designed it. So what we're doing is we are designing and building one of each of these designs. These models will be about 12 feet high, and we're going to build them and design them, and we're going to put them in a wave wind tank facility. And there's 3 facilities we're looking at across the country right now, one in Canada. And then we're going to put it through its paces. So we're going to generate waves in these tanks. How many of you have been in a wave pool? Yeah, in a wave pool, of course, again. Now, this is a real wave pool where you can generate whatever wave geometry you want and whatever wave period and frequencies that you want. And you have wind also, big fans actually blowing to generate the winds. So we're going to put these things in wave wind tanks and test them out. I know Des already tested this and did very well in California. What we're going to be doing is we're going to take 3 different designs, the spar design, the tension leg platform design, and a design similar to Des' design, and put them simultaneously in a wave wind tank and put them through their paces to simulate the effect of 50 to 100 years worth of mid-ocean conditions. Okay. And that's going to get done by the end of the summer. Then we're going to pick one of these designs and say, you know what, this one seems to work better than the others, and that's what we'll build as a third-scale model and put it out on the Mount Higgins. The other really important thing about the third scale model, it's 100 feet above the water, is that it allows us to find out what happens to it very quickly without having to wait 50 years to find out what the 50-year storm would do. Because it's small, it's only about 100 feet versus 300 feet above the water, the relative size of the waves and the size of the structure are such that, and we've done some data, which looked at the statistics of winds and waves in the Gulf of Maine, and if you put it in February, in January or February, in the water, in 1 week, you're 80% likely during that week to see a 100-year event on that structure. Isn't that cool? So in 1 week, I'm 80% likely to find an event that would be an equivalent to a 100-year event on the bigger structure. But of course, on the bigger structure, I'm going to have to wait 100 years to see a 100-year event. So there's a real reason to go to third-scale models, is we can find out what happens in 100-year in a much shorter period of time. So we'll do that, and then we'll build the larger unit after that. So this is the homework we'll do before we build the larger unit. I hope that answers your question.
Who will be doing these three designs?
We have a team of over 40 engineers and scientists working on the projects as we speak. And they come from the leaders in the industry, the offshore oil industry and offshore. So we have the National Wind Technology Center up in Colorado. It's the largest center for wind in the country. Their engineers are working with us. Technip is one of the companies I told you about that builds the oil rigs. They're part of the team. The University of Maine engineers, CalLab, and others, Bath Ironworks, Chimbro, all of these companies have engineers and naval architects working with us as a team to design these units.
I have a question here. To Des's your knowledge or yours, Habib, has there ever been a structural failure of any of these offshore towers?
The floating ones?
There's only one of them. The floating and or the driven ones.
In terms of the floating ones, there's only one of them in the world right now. So we haven't had a chance to get into hail yet. There's one of them off the coast of Norway, the one that you saw. Right. It's the only one that's currently operating in the world.
How about...
And that's done very well, by the way. So far, the data that we've gotten is that it's generated more energy than the ones on land. This thing has a 2.3 megawatt Siemens turbine on top of it, and it's generated more energy in the water since September than the equivalent on land. So it's done very well so far in that first trial. So there hasn't been a failure yet. Are we concerned about failure? Sure we are. We're all concerned about the perfect storm, right? And what happens in a perfect storm. And that's what we're designing for. Okay, so now, in terms of the fixed phase units, yes, there's been a lot of issues, initially at least, in terms of corrosion, not failure, but corrosion issues. The steel towers are being corroded and so forth. And that's why we're looking at composites. We're looking at when you're out 20 miles or 30 miles offshore, the last thing you want to do is do a lot of maintenance costs. So by going to composites, you can reduce the corrosion costs as well. And that's part of the designs that we're developing. So the designs we're developing, it's not just material costs. It's also, you're taking material costs, you're talking fabrication costs, deployment costs, and maintenance costs. You add it all up, and that's the function we're trying to minimize. Okay? That's your question.
Gentlemen, two questions. The first one should be quick. For the fishermen, and I think it's your design, consolidation, having a checker pattern like that, like a 5x4 versus a 1x20, the blades aren't going to disrupt any blades behind it, right? The first blades producing the turbine behind it's not going to get any sort of loss.
Yeah, actually, no matter where you are, if you put blades back to back, you're going to lose some power, right? Because that wind is reduced in speed when it gets to the next blade. But there are rules of sound typically that the industry uses. No matter what the design of the platform is, it's all independent of the design of the platform. Typically, side by side, you want to go about 5 to 7 blade diameters, and then back to back about 10 blade diameters. That's the rule of thumb. Okay, to try to reduce the interference from one blade or shading. As you know, when you go racing, you try to race and cut off your opponent that way. The same thing happens with these turbines. So you got to get far enough to reduce those losses. And then, so in the prevailing wind direction, you want them at least 10 diameters apart, away, back to back. Perpendicular to the prevailing wind direction, you want about 5 to 7 diameters apart.
And the second question, shelf life?
Shelf life.
These things, how are they projected? Because I know they probably haven't.
The floating ones, of course, haven't been around.
Right.
The goal here, in most of these units, to have them operating for at least 20 years. We'd like to see 25 or 30 years. What happens, though, when you see shelf lives, what really goes first right now, even on land-based turbines, are the gearboxes. So that those actually go faster than the rest. So when you see shelf life, every component has its own shelf life. we're hoping that if we do our design right on the towers, okay, and flowing units, say Sedez does a great job on his design, and then those would outlast the mechanics, outlast the turbines. So if the turbine has a 20-year shelf life, I'd like to hear, to see that the structure of the flowing turbine would have maybe a 30 or 40-year life. So what you could do in 20 years, you can what we call repower the turbines. So you come over there, you tow them back to shore, you take the turbine off, you take the blades off, you put a new turbine in. In 20 years, hopefully the turbines have improved and you get a better turbine problem. And actually, the Germans are great planners. They're already planning refurbishing the offshore farms that they're building today. Okay, and they've figured out how many jobs they can create when they need to do this. It's called repowering the turbines. So 20 years is at most the plant, the equipment, and the floating turbines and the foundation, I know, to last more than that, 30 to 40 years. So you can repower them at least once.
Des, have you done any studies on its shelf life or anything?
Well, we don't have a platform in the water yet. We hope to have one in 2011 off the coast of Portugal. It's probably going to be a 2-megawatt turbine on our platform. I think Habib is correct. 20 years is kind of the industry standard for the life of a turbine before it needs to be repowered. We don't yet know how well structures can stand up in the ocean environment. It's going to be pretty critical as to whether there's composites involved. And I don't know if anybody else heard this piece, but some Chinese scientists just the other day discovered that cigarette butts, did anybody hear this piece? Marinated in some kind of chemical compound actually create a galvanizing agent that could be applied to steel that resists corrosion at sea. So we don't know what's out there. It is a new world.
Did he smoke before he said that?
He smoked a cigarette first.
Dad, I have a question for you. Given what the future looks like over the horizon, offshore, deep water, lots of money being spent, lots of work being done, it sounds to me like carving a large road up Ragged Mountain for a couple of windmills seems like a vanity project for Camden. And I'm wondering why serious consideration is being given to trying to go through the permitting process of that, where this seems like a much more reasonable suggestion.
Well, it's a good question. I personally believe that the conversation around energy and how we use it and the effects of it, both on a community level and also on the national and global level, are important. And I wouldn't say any one is more important than the other. It's very easy for all of us to use the energy we do and throw the light switch and not understand the impacts on a coal miner or combustion coming from an Ohio power plant into our air and our water. We all understand these issues, but until we really start to wrestle with what it looks like, for us to take part in, participate in the electrons we create and use for ourselves and our community, I don't think we really fully understand it. So I wouldn't call it a vanity project. You know, we're probably looking at potentially 6 megawatts. That's not a vanity project. That can have a serious impact on some of the towns and their residents. What we've been told over and over again by George Baker and his group is, don't expect energy savings here per se, but do expect energy security, to Habib's point. So, you know, that's an on the paper monetary return, but I think there's lots of other potential returns about how we think of ourselves as a community and how we use energy and how we participate globally in use of resources.
Thank you. Scott Dickerson. I guess if I read this correctly, and I know we're really glossing over the crest of the waves, if I can use that metaphor. What's the point of doing any wind generation projects on land? Why wouldn't we invest all of our capital in going offshore right away, as fast as we can develop this technology, if it in fact has the extreme minimal impacts that you're projecting here? Now, we know there's more to this, because we know there's fishing conflicts and things like that at play out here, but let's say for a moment that the impacts are genuinely less offshore. Why aren't we making our capital investment to go to that technology, which is much larger and has apparently much less impact?
I mean, let me take an early stab and then we can follow up if you don't mind. Because our company has been looking for money all around the world. We're looking for investors, and everybody is looking for renewable energy solutions right now, and yet when it comes time to put money down on technology that still hasn't been tried and tested, it's difficult. So here we are, our first project, we're building in Portugal of all places. Seems like an odd place, but they had the aptitude and the interest and the money to put a project up. So, you know, I think all of this is in the future, Scott. I think we've got to pay attention to what's in front of us right now, whether it's on land or inshore. I do think deep water is coming, but it's not here right now. It's going to take government, in my opinion, to really step forward and put up real money to make the early investments to prove the case. The government so far has beginning to be willing to do that, but hasn't really put up the big money yet.
Abe, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I agree with that. Let me back up a little bit. You know, like all the solutions that we look for, we just discovered globally the importance of deep water floating wind turbines. And then that realization across the globe is happening faster and faster every day. And governments across the world are starting to invest in large amounts of that money. Japan is in the University of Tokyo, for example, right now, has a major program to floating offshore wind. China is looking at floating offshore wind in a large manner as well right now. So I think it's going to be a global race to figure out how to crack that particular nut. Land-based wind is here now. The technology has been out there since 20 years, so it's easy to go to that solution right now. So we've evolved that way historically, but the future, in my opinion, would be the future if we're all right and our predictions are correct, that the floating offshore wind will replace it in the long run those other options. The other thing we need to look at is not just wind, but we need to look at all the options we have in front of us. Solar, for example, we need to look at some of the hydro capacities and others. So I see the future as a mosaic of solutions. And where offshore wind, floating offshore wind, at least for Maine, is the biggest part of that mosaic.
It's an interesting parallel if you follow the oil and gas drilling design world and also their movement from on-land drilling to near-shore drilling to deep-water drilling. And really begrudgingly, at every step in the way, they went there because that's where the resource was. And I think wind is modeling exactly the same template from on land to near shore to deep water. Fortunately for us, we don't have the dire consequences of the failure that the oil and gas platform land has.
The other piece I want to tell you about, the environmental piece is not very well understood, the floating offshore wind. Okay? There are real issues that we're trying to understand. One of the reasons we're doing the test off Monhegan Island is we're going to have sensors all over the place, under the water, to look at the vibrations and what effects it might have on mammal life, the concern about the birds. All of those are very important parts we have. But the biggest team we've got, actually, currently working on this project, is not designing the turbines, but trying to figure out what we'll do to the environment. So we have a whole set of people trying to figure that out. The other thing is, where do you locate these turbines? Okay, we're concerned about everything, the whales, the fish, the mammals, and all of those are real serious issues, but unless we have experiments very well controlled and limited initially, we never know the answer. And that's why we're doing the work off Monhegan Island. And again, when you're putting the thing out there for 2 months, that 2 months can be a lot of data, a lot of hard drives being filled with data to try to figure out what it will do to the environment around it. But it's going to be there for 2 months and we'll pull it out. Okay, so the whatever impact they'll have will be very minimal, at least that first effect will give us a lot of data to understand what really happens. The other thing is we've developed a 400-layer GIS database of the Gulf of Maine over the last 3 years that has everything we pretty much know about the Gulf of Maine, not only how deep the water is, what kind of soil conditions you have out in there, where the shipping channels are, where some of the fishermen are. We've worked a lot with the Island Institute in terms of where the fishing areas are. All of those are in different layers of that database. And we're trying to figure out how to locate these farms to minimize the impact on the environment. And that's very important to us. So at any point in time, any of you would like to see how much data there is in the database, we'd be happy to show it to you. 400 layers of data, these are terabytes of data sitting in hard drive, to try to figure this out, sift through it and say, does it make sense to put it here versus here? And no matter what we do, we're going to have an effect on the environment. But the question is, how do we minimize it? That's what we're trying to find out.
I mean, just to follow up on that question, and I wrote down this off of one of your slides, so I might have got it wrong, but didn't you have up on your slides, to follow up on the question, I mean, the question of the value of land-based wind versus offshore wind.
Right.
I believe you had up on a slide that it was $7 billion for 3 gigawatts onshore
right.
versus $20 billion for 5 gigawatts offshore.
Right.
So at least in short-term projections, we have a huge cost difference per
gigawatt for onshore versus offshore?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Is it going to cost more to do offshore than onshore? Initially, yes. Okay. The first few projects, yes. But remember I said you can generate twice as much energy per tower offshore than you do on land. So that a single tower might cost you, on land right now, a turbine will cost you for large projects. Community projects are a lot more expensive, and small wind is a lot more expensive than community. Community is a lot more expensive than larger farms. The least expensive form of wind energy is the larger farms right now, per kilowatt hours. So when you look at the land-based wind, you're looking at about $2.25 to $2.50 a watt is the installed capacity of a project. Okay, so for every watt you generate, it's $2.25 to $2.50 a watt. Offshore, our goal is $3.50 to $4 a watt. Okay, so if you're at $3.50 a watt offshore for installed capacity, up to $4 a watt, and you generate twice the energy, twice the income, you can divide that by two, then you're back to about $2 a watt. So yes, it costs more for the capital, but that capital is producing a lot more electricity for you. So it ends up being, if we do our job right and everything works out, it will be less expensive than land-based. Okay. That make sense?
I have about 30 questions, but I'll just keep it short. Two things that struck me, one about the land-based question. Wind is intermittent, and so isn't it true that the grid is always on standby for when the wind shuts down? That's my question. That's my question. Thank you.
Is that in fact the case? Is that your question?
Yes
it is the case. Yeah, I mean, the grid is there and it's supporting the peak load. And if no wind, for instance, because it's intermittent, it's going to have to get those electrons from somewhere else. Sure.
Right. So it's always on standby. And so I'm just wondering what we're really saying.
The one asterisk next to that answer is Habib's point, which the task force has been talking about a lot, which is picture all of our cars in Maine having 350-pound lithium batteries that are storing electrons from renewable wind when it's blowing. We've essentially created a way now of storing and profiling the intermittency and leveling it out. We're not there yet, but it's possible.
Right. And that'd be down the road, but I'm thinking of right now with three on Rabbit Mountain. That's a concern of mine. It's, I guess I'll see it at the energy committee. And then my other question has to do with the analogy to the oil and wind manufactures electricity. That might be the wrong word. But it's my understanding that U.S. gets their electricity only about 5% from oil. Is that
true? Well, yeah. 50% of our electricity in the U.S. comes from coal. So
right.
Coal-fired power plants produces 50%. 20% is nuclear. So oil is a small fraction, but where are you driving with that question?
Well, I was a little troubled by the analogy in the costs and
right.
How, you know, it was talking about the Gulf and the price of oil. It
right.
seems like the analysis of wind with the cost of oil, I wasn't getting the connection
okay.
there.
But let's go back to July 2008, okay? What's the first thing that went up? Gasoline costs, right? The pump. That's what went up first. What happens next? What happens next? Heating oil went up, right? What happened next? Natural gas prices went up. What happened next? The quarter would double. Okay. What I'm trying to say here is, whoever's going to set it's a market-driven cost. It's a cost that you got to look at this as the energy basket. Okay. And when one form of energy goes up, the rest eventually will follow because that's the price you're paying for it. So it's a market-driven cost. And we've lived that in July 2008. I'm just trying to go back to tell you what we've lived in July 2008 can recur again.
Right. I just wanted to make the point that we only get about 5% of our electrical needs in the United States from oil.
Right. It's 5% from oil, but that's really what's not going to drive the price of electricity. What's going to drive the price of electricity is the price of energy altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of a follow-up on that question. You mentioned, I forget the gentleman's name, who talked about peak oil and
Charlie Maxwell?
Yeah, in 2014. I mean, there are some people, Matt Simmons being one, that suggests we've already reached peak oil. So
I mean, one way or the other, we're either there or we're there quickly.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, it's going to happen, I think. It's,
yeah. You know, I'm not a broad analyst, and I don't pretend to be one. As I said, I just hear what all the analysts tell us. Quite a few more and more now that are lining up behind Charlie Maxwell and Matt Simmons in believing that peak oil is here, and it's now. And frankly, when you start to look at, we're going out there and drilling in oil in a mile deep water. You think we're doing it because it's fun to go there and do it in CC? It's doing it because we can't find it anywhere else. Okay, so we are running out of oil. That's why we're going there. And so it's real, yes.
So did that platform that blew up, was that a billion dollar?
I don't know what the cost was. Do you know what the cost was? I don't know what the particular cost of that platform was. But this was not a production platform. This was an exploration platform.
Right. Right.
The production platform will cost you more. But yeah, that's an exploration platform.
I have a question for Suzanne. My name is Greta Kalesian, and in regard to the health effects that some people on the Fox Islands have been experiencing, what kind of monitoring and studies are going forward, and who's conducting them?
As far as health effects, I mean, there's, I think when you look at sort of this issue around the noise, there are folks that will say that the noise is causing an annoyance and a disruption is something that people don't like, but that there's a limitation in terms of the research that's been done out there that suggests that there's an actual physical health impact to individuals that live near wind turbines. There is obviously, you're probably referring to Nina Pierpoint in wind turbine syndrome that's out there, and you know, she seems to suggest that there are physical health effects to it. I haven't heard other than, I don't know personally of any complaints other than people having trouble sleeping, what effects that these individuals on Vinyl Haven who are being vocal about their issues with the turbine. I'm not aware of anything other than that, and we have been trying to collect individualized information on each resident's experience with the noise. So we've been asking since the issues were raised for neighbors to be logging their experiences and to try to better understand under which circumstances the noise is most bothersome to them, so that when the co-op goes back to look at all the sound data that's been collected, they can better understand what are the circumstances that we're really trying to target that will have the greatest impact to make the, you know, the best improvement to these issues that those neighbors are expressing. So some of the neighbors, I think, are participating in providing that information, and it's been limited, I think, from others, but I think that's sort of going to be the ongoing effort, is to continue to have that dialogue with the neighbors that are concerned and to get as much information from them.
So at this point, it's only logging of their symptoms?
Correct.
There's nothing else. No other monitoring.
Was there a bogus?
Excuse
I saw me? That Harvard business guy that you worked with,
yeah.
in his proposal, he was talking about they were going to put in Bose noise canceling.
Yeah, so those, I mean, that's not monitoring their effects. There are a number of things that are being, I mean, a number of things that are being done right now in terms of looking at ways to deal with that situation out there. We were, Fox Islands Wind was recently awarded a grant from the Maine Technology Institute to develop active noise cancellation to be deployed in neighbors' homes. So it's similar technology to what the Bose headphones do. Basically, you identify the sound wave that's most bothersome, you create another one that's, you know, the opposite to cancel that out. So we're working with a Maine company to further develop that technology and to try that out in some of the homes on Vinyl Haven. We also have received a commitment from the National Renewable Energy Lab that's based in Boulder, Colorado, and some of the nation's top wind experts were on Vinyl Haven earlier this week interviewing the neighbors that have had issues to better understand their concerns. And then there was a technical team that met on the site with various sound engineers to better understand the specifics of that site. And they've gone back to their offices and will be looking at various ways to match up sort of a technical solution to the issues that they're hearing from the neighbors. So there's quite a bit of work that's being done on that front. We've already looked into a few options in the past few months to try to deal with this issue, made some modifications to the turbines already. So I think it's something the co-op is quite committed to doing, and hoping the neighbors will continue to cooperate and to provide their input on what's most troubling to them.
Thank you.
guess I'll go ahead since I have the mic. That's another question. Is there any interest in closer to shore wind farming than what Dr. Geiger is proposing, which is the anything that be within state waters, say, or anything like that?
I haven't heard of anything. I know there were some inshore wind developers around. They came to some of the task force meetings. Haven't heard anything, scuttle butter otherwise, that something's pending. The reality is that there's revenue from the state of Maine that comes within that 3 mile state limit. There's revenue sharing within the 6 mile MMS limit. So, you know, it's. I think there's a chance it could happen if the legislature and the state is kind of moving into deeper water. So we may have turned off the inshore guys for now.
And I had a question for Dr. Geiger, and that is, I've been reading some information from meteorologists, especially a Norwegian Dr. Grostrom, concerned about what happens when you, is there a climatic effect once you have X number of wind farms pulling electricity? And I guess given the very dramatic increase in ocean wind farms and certainly of land wind farms, does the University of Maine or Deep Sea Wind taking a look at all of that issue?
Yeah, very good question. The question is, are we going to change the wind climate or the wind speeds or the wave currents by putting these out there? A lot of people have looked at that for land-based wind, and the conclusion is that it's so minuscule, it doesn't really affect things very much. And think of it this way. When you put wind farms back-to-back, wind towers back-to-back, you put them about half a mile apart, okay, wind towers, because the wind speed comes back to where it was half a mile later. So the effect is very localized for that, so we don't see really impact at the global scale. Yet, I've read what you've talked about. I've seen some of those studies. But the scientific community doesn't take them very seriously.
Doesn't take it very seriously.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But very good point. I think we should look at it. We should be aware of it.
There's a certain law of physics that says the energy isn't just created from nothing. You're certainly extracting it from one place and taking it to another.
That's correct. What you need to look at is you know, the best winds actually in the world, the major currents, are really much higher than that. Mm-hmm. As the elevation increases, the wind gets better and better and better. So the majority, the overwhelming majority of the energy, wind energy in the atmosphere of the Earth, is much higher than where that wind, those towers are. Okay, mm-hmm. So the real energy is way above that. Okay, right. So that's what drives the global currents, and that's why what happens down in there, which is within 10 diameters of the turbine, is minuscule to the global movements of the planet. Right. So,
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's what. Most scientists have looked at that and said that's really negative.
Hi, I've just got a question on the organization of the consortium. Like, who's in charge, or how you manage, you know, in terms of, it's fantastic what's been presented tonight and what everybody's spending energy on, but I don't quite understand.
How it works?
Yeah, how it works.
Yeah, the consortium, essentially, the DOE asked for a consortium. Okay, when they put a proposal out there for people to do this kind of work, they wanted a consortium of industry and universities to compete for the best ideas to move forward. So what we did is we pulled together companies in a variety of sectors that can help us design and build the best turbines. Okay? So the companies are organized in different groups. There are some companies such as Des's company that has designed for floating wind turbines. There are companies who are contractors who build turbines, such as Chimbrow, and potentially can manufacture and deploy Chimbrow and Bad Pine Works. And there's companies who are environmental companies, who understand how to go out there and have done some experience over the last many years looking at wind farms. So there's environmental companies. There are national labs involved with us, Sandia National Lab, as well as National Wind Technology Center. And there are investment firms. So there's a whole bunch of different companies. There's material suppliers that are involved in terms of corrosion-resistant materials and others. There's law firms involved in terms of permitting issues and others. And there's university scientists as well. So it's a whole group. Our group is divided into 7 task forces or task groups, and each task group has one task group leader. And every week, everybody gets together. The task group leaders gets together and compare notes and there's timelines.
How are decisions made then?
Each task group, of course, makes its own decision and has goals they have to meet as part of the big structure of the program. So all the input is provided by within each task group. So each task group makes their own decisions and has to meet certain goals within the task groups. So, for example, the permitting, the environmental task group, we've got some of the leading scientists in this area in the state working with us, the law firms and others. So these are examples of task groups that function almost each separately, but can get together and compare notes to make sure they're all meeting the targets. So weekly meetings. Okay. And where the task groups get together. So.
I know Habib has a long drive home, and I know you have an early meeting tomorrow morning. So if you don't mind, if there's really any other questions somebody has, I think we all deserve to be here.